Amina Silmi to give an opening talk to you this evening concerning the role and the status of women in Islam.
Assalamu alaikum. Tonight, I'm here to discuss that poor oppressed creature known as the Muslim woman and that law that oppresses them, Islam, specifically fundamental Islam. Islam is my chosen path, and I get really frustrated when I read about how women are paradoxically on the front lines of a movement that represses them. Islam in no way represses anyone. Islam is, in fact, the ultimate liberator. The women's liberation movement of this country would have benefited enormously from the guidance in the Quran. But then if we'd been following the Quran, the women's liberation movement wouldn't have been necessary. In Islam, it is recognized that men and women are different. However, while they're recognized as different, that in no way means that they are not equal. In fact, they are very much equal, as was mentioned in the ayah that opened. The Quran, which was revealed to Muhammad, was written down at the time of the revelation and has been protected from any change. It stands now as it was then, and it stands as a constant reminder and protector of women's rights. No aspect of the woman's value, import, or capabilities has been ignored. Amongst the things that are covered in the Quran is procreation. In Surah 4, Ayah 1, it says, "Reverence God through whom ye demand your mutual rights, and reverence the womb that bore you, for God ever watches over you." The mother that bore us must have our reverence. The wife through whom the men enter parentage must have their reverence. And the act of sex itself must also be looked at with reverence. Also, the birth of female children was covered in Islam. According to Islam, the female child is not a matter of shame. It's a blessing. The Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam said, "Whoever does good to a girl child, it will be a curtain to him from hell." Another time he said, "Whosoever cares for two girls till they come of age shall be in the next world with me like two fingers close to each other. Whosoever has a daughter and does not bury her alive, nor scold her, nor show partiality to his other male children, God shall bring him into paradise." Islam also dealt with another thing that's been a problem for women. That's the guilt for the original sin. After all, it was Pandora that opened the box that let evil onto the earth. And it was Eve who forced that fateful apple into Adam's mouth. But in the Quran, it says both were tempted, both sinned, both repented, and both were forgiven. Some people think that the man may be held slightly more responsible for original sin because the man is also given a degree of responsibility for the woman, while the woman has no responsibility for the man's actions. Women were also given, over 1,400 years ago, the right to own her own property and to conduct her own affairs. Now remember, the Quran is over 1,400 years old. In 1870, Great Britain shocked the rest of the world by passing the Married Women's Property Act. The law gave only limited property rights to women, but it was considered quite scandalous at the time. That was only the beginning of women's property rights. Even here in this country, there are some areas where women do not have full property rights. Last year when I was in Virginia, I was talking with an elderly lady whose husband had passed away, and she was trying to sell her house and could not because of a law that was on the book that said her husband or other male family member had to sign the papers, and every male family member she had was dead. And she was stuck with this house and she wanted to sell it. According to Islam, we have full control over whatever we own and full right to acquire whatever we desire. There's no limitations on us at all. And what we own does not require any permission from our husbands to use or dispose of. We also have the right to conduct our own businesses. In fact, the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam worked for a woman who later became his wife. It was Khadija who owned the trading company that he went to work for when he was 20 years of age. That set two examples. Number one, that it was acceptable for a man to work for a woman. And number two, that it was acceptable for a woman to own a business and conduct her own affairs in that business. Also in Islam, women were for the first time given the right to witness contracts. Now it's true that in some cases in Islam it requires two women to one man, but this is only in certain contracts where it involves the borrowing and loaning of money. There are other instances where a woman's witness alone is enough, and there is one instance where a woman's witness is more powerful than a man's witness. The rights of women didn't stop here. The previously mentioned rights were then secured and expanded by granting women the right to education. Not just the right to education. Women were ordered to be educated. We were told to go to the ends of the earth if necessary. Slaves could be freed for teaching a woman how to read and write. It wasn't a matter of just men. It was for women, too. The education of the women may well have been a factor in the number of women in early Islamic history who became known as distinguished scholars. Amongst those are Hafsa, the daughter of Omar, who was known as the keeper of the Quran, Aisha, the daughter of Abu Bakr, who is well known for a memory like a tape recorder and reported the most hadiths of anyone. She also wrote many scholarly works on history and on Islamic law. But along with the right for education, we were given the right to express ourselves. We were given the right to voice our opinions and our ideas and our feelings in public. On one occasion, Omar, and for those of you who don't know about Omar, Omar was one very tough man. He was well known to have a quick temper and a very strong nature, and he wasn't the kind of person that anybody really cared to cross. But there was one occasion where he was suggesting that a law be passed, and a woman stood up and continued to disagree with him until finally he stood and said, a woman is right and Omar is wrong. So even right after the death of the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam, we could stand before the Caliph, the ruler, and disagree and express our opinion and have no fear. Our opinion was taken for what it was, and it didn't matter whether we were male or female. Judgment was judgment. Islam as a legal system also dealt with the issue of inheritance. Now, inheritance has been a problem over all years and is still a problem in this country especially. You watch families totally torn apart because they can't decide what's going to be done with an inheritance. The first thing Islam did was classify inheritance. And inheritance is not something you have earned. Inheritance is something that has been given to you. It's a kind of a charity. Now in Islam, the woman has no financial obligations. Even in the worst of times, she has no financial obligations. If she has a job, she does not have to use that money to support herself. Her father is responsible, her brothers are responsible, her uncles are responsible, if there are no male relatives. The society is responsible. The man, on the other hand, has an almost unlimited degree of responsibility. He's responsible for his wife and for his children. He's responsible for his parents, for his brothers, for his sisters. He's responsible for the parents of his wife. He's responsible for aunts and uncles. He's responsible for any of the poor and needy in his community, and it goes on and it goes on and it goes on. So if a charity is to be given, it should go where it would be most needed, and that would be the man, because he has the greater stress placed on him financially. The thing that is quite remarkable, and everyone keeps passing by, is the fact that Roman was guaranteed a part of inheritance. There are still many legal systems where all inheritance goes to the firstborn son, or this or that. But this was the first, and is still the only one, that states absolutely how much she's going to get. And it goes beyond that, because it keeps the family from being torn apart by arguing over who's going to get how much. It's settled. It's resolved. There's nothing to discuss. And it's a great burden that is relieved from all of society for this. Okay, now we move on into marriage. In the process of getting married, it's very true that the families on both sides are very involved in marriage. They do a great deal of work finding people that they think are suitable for their son or for their daughter. But this in no way means that the daughter is bought or sold, or that marriages are done without permission. A couple cannot be married unless they agree to the marriage. This is Islamic law now. Okay? The family involvement, though, is very important, because the family should know their children fairly well. I mean, I know what my sons really like. I know what my sons really need. I knew what my daughter needed. I knew what my daughter wanted. And so when I'm talking to the girls, my daughter's married, but when I'm talking to the girls about my sons, I can have a pretty good feel about whether or not this girl is really going to be able to make it with my son, or whether there's too many areas where contention is going to be a source of absolute destruction. Now, my oldest son, who's 17, he doesn't look at girls with his mind. He has a totally different orientation. But, alhamdulillah, he does respect his mother, and he does listen to me, and he has taken my advice up to this point on girls that he has brought to me. And the one that he's currently considering is the first one that both of us are in agreement seems to be a pretty nice girl. But by going through this process, inshallah, we will be able to avoid problems in the marriage and maybe even divorce. The involvement in the marriage doesn't end with the choosing or the helping of the choice of the spouse, okay? It goes on in that the family is continually involved. We have extended family system in Islam. You don't get married and go off and become a totally separate unit. You get married, you become a part of a larger unit. And this extended family system helps us to be able to work out our problems a little bit better, too. We have other people for sounding boards. We have other people to help us out during times where there's a lot of stress or a lot of problems going on. So the extended family is very important to us. And my youngest son, he's an idealist, and he's a long way from getting married, I hope, is very clear on where things stand when he gets married, you know. And he was telling his Islamic studies teacher, yes, when I get married, my mother's going to live with us. And she says, but what if your wife doesn't like your mother? Well, then she's not going to be my wife. And he goes on and he explains to her, well, you see, she should like my mother, because my mother is there to protect her rights. And then his Islamic studies teacher says, well, are you sure you want that? And he says, well, it's going to make my life hard, yeah. But he has a healthy attitude. He has the idea. He has an understanding of what it is, you know, to have the extended family and to maintain the support structure as it goes on. Now, divorce is allowed in Islam, but of all the things that are allowed, it's the thing that's hated the most. A man can declare divorce by saying I divorce you 3 times during 3 different menstrual cycles. Okay? But a woman can also obtain a divorce. During the time of the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam, divorces were granted for simple things like, in one case, the woman did not like the way her husband looked. And the divorce was granted because she just didn't like the way he looked. So the limitations on the woman by Islam as far as being able to get a divorce aren't there. But divorce is to be avoided. And before you go to divorce, you have to go through arbitration. And during the arbitration, the couple has to stay together. They have to continue trying to work out the problems. We don't just fall off and get divorced. It doesn't work that way, not amongst true Muslims. During the marriage, the woman's rights have been protected. Okay? It's said that when a Muslim marries, he protects half of his religion, and that he should practice righteousness to secure the remaining half. And the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam said, marriage is my way. Whoso loves my conduct should follow my way, and who strays from my way is not for me. The family life of the Prophet is a unique example of affection and kindness and patience and forgiveness, of gentleness, of civility, patience. Married families of today could learn a lot by studying how he conducted himself in his marriage relations. Muhammad introduced a new dimension into the human relationship of man and woman, enriching the family with love, pleasure, comfort, mercy, and security, enabling them both to gain moral goodness and spiritual excellence through their relationship. So while the woman is protected during the marriage, and we try to avoid the divorce, her protection in case of divorce is not forgotten. A man cannot abuse the woman in order to make her seek divorce, because if she seeks divorce, she has to return a part of the dowry. He's forbidden to speak anything bad about her or to hold her in suspense. Okay, he has to either maintain his marriage relationship or he has to let her go. He can't just go away from her. He remains 100% financially responsible for the children, and in some instances, for his ex-wife. And this might be a good time for us to go in and talk a little bit about the woman in the workplace and the ERA. Okay? ERA was struggling for equal pay. In 1939, a woman earned 63 cents to a man's dollar. In 1985, she earned 64 cents to a man's dollar, a gain of a penny in almost 50 years. In 1987, 23% of all working women earned less than $10,000 a year at a full-time job. 80% of these women are heads of single-parent families. Now, the average child support that is awarded is $300 a month, but 60% of all of the divorced fathers contribute nothing to the care of their children. And this doesn't even take into account all of the children who have been fathered outside of marriages. These children have no rights. These mothers have no rights to assistance. This puts an unbelievable sense of woman. And every increasing number of children are being a party. After all, that economic party and women is created into a system of different problems for children. The flow of the children who are powerful, child abuse, drug use, and their dependence. In Islam, it's ordered that we have equal pay. There's no difference between what a man earns and what a woman earns. The Quran says to give the worker their due before the sweat is dry on the brow. It doesn't say and pay the woman half of what the man earns. It's to be paid. Now, many Muslim women do choose not to work. And the Islamic social system makes that decision possible. He must, women, have lost something exceedingly important because we've lost the freedom of choice. Women are forced into the 9-to-5 rut, sticking their children into child care systems and forcing themselves into stress and strain situations by trying to run a household, work a full-time job, be a mother, in some cases still even be a wife. And there's no time for themselves. They're burning out. Even many American women now are choosing to live a less expensive lifestyle and stay at home because they're starting to recognize the damage this does to their children and to themselves. I have to cover very quickly two big subjects. Okay, we save them for last. One has to do with the hijab, the Islamic dress of the woman. Now, to many Western educated people, this is a sign of our oppression. This isn't so with a Muslim woman who has an understanding of Islam. This, to us, is our badge of honor. This is my right. This is my human right to be able to wear this. This identifies me as being a Muslim. In this country, I do not have the freedom to dress the way I would like to. In this country, if I go out with the face veil, there's a few of you that haven't given up the face veil, and I applaud you for your courage. Because when we go out, we take a lot of problems. When I used to cover my face, I walked into a bank once to cash a check, and I walked into the bank, and the guard hit the guns at his hips, you know. They really didn't know what to do with me. They did finally cash the check, but I had to go in the back room and show the lady my face, you know, before she would do it. But they were terrified of me. And I found that in just about everywhere I went, that people were antagonistic. Well, forget working a job with a face veil on. We can accept that that's impossible over here. You can't wear this much and get a job either. You can't wear this much and get a job and support yourself. It seems in this country, if we are to survive, because we don't have the Islamic social system that will support us and take care of us, the only way that we can survive is to bear ourselves. And this is, to us, a violation of our human rights. We would like to be able to maintain our dignity and maintain our dress. It's not oppressive to us. I'm very comfortable the way I am dressed. I don't want to wear less clothing, and it doesn't hinder me in any way. I ski, I sail, I horseback ride, I go camping, I go hiking, I climb trees with my grandchildren, I fly kites. I can do anything I want to dress the way I am, but it hurts my heart to see how frightened people are of me. And this brings us to this article. This article, what it has done, has increased people's fear, increased people's antagonism, increased their mistrust of us, increased their conviction that Islam is a religion for ignorant fools. It's making it very difficult for us. And now I have a sign here that says I have to finish quickly. I didn't get a chance to hit on polygamy, so we'll have to deal with polygamy later. Assalamu alaikum.
Thank you. Our next speaker, Deborah Scroggins, will give her statement. Again, I ask that you show her the same courtesy and respect that you did to Amina Asumi, and let her complete her statement without interruption. Thank you.
Hello, thank you for having me here tonight. Well, I'm just going to start out with a little explanation of how the Atlanta Journal-Constitution decided to write the articles, and then talk a bit about what they said and some of the issues they raised. I've been reported traveling and writing about the Middle East for 12 years now, and I had spent a lot of time in Sudan, which has had a succession of Islamic governments, or at least governments that call themselves Islamic, and have become very interested in the situation of women. But what really piqued our interest was the Algerian elections last year. And what happened in Algeria, as probably most of you know, is that a Islamic party actually won the first round of national elections. And then the Algerian military cracked down and put a stop to the democratic experiment. And the Western governments and the military government that took its place in Algeria said that one of the reasons that they had, well, the army said the reason it had made the crackdown, and the Western government said they supported it because the Islamic National Salvation Front had intended to restrict the rights of women. And there had been a number of professional women's groups who had demonstrated against the Islamic Salvation Front. But when you actually looked at the election results, you found that a majority of Algerian women appeared to have voted for the front. So this raised the question in my mind and the mind of my editors of what exactly was happening in the Middle East. There seemed to be a paradoxical choice between democracy and what, at least in the West, would be perceived as women's rights. It seemed that if democracy, you know, if free and fair elections were to be held in many countries throughout the Middle East, there was a good chance that Islamic parties, political parties, would win, who would then try to restrict women's freedom of movement, and that women themselves, in, you know, large numbers, were supporting these movements. So that's what we set out to look at, the political movement that's sweeping the Middle East now. And so we went to four countries. The first one was Turkey, and what we were looking at there was Turkey has is one of the only countries that has a civil legal code there. But there is a burgeoning Islamic movement, and women are very active in it, and they would like to return to strict Islamic law, which in Turkey would mean giving up a lot of rights. So we spent time interviewing the most highly educated female professionals and students about their reasons for wanting to join that movement. Then we went on to Pakistan, where Pakistan since 1979 had a set of Islamic, or what they consider to be what the government claims are Islamic laws. And we wanted to look at how they were affecting women. The number of women who have been arrested under these laws has gone up from practically nothing to over 4,000. So we spent time there with that. Then we went on to Afghanistan just before the guerrilla takeover and spent time in an area controlled by one of the Islamic factions. Then planned to bring to Kabul an area where women had a lot more freedom in their life. And then went on to Kuwait, where, as I'm sure many of you know, women at that time were trying to agitate to get the vote. Since then, they've had the elections without a female vote, and the Islamic parties had a big victory. So that's what the articles were about. We tried to pick two relatively liberal countries and two very conservative countries and look at that. Now, let me just go over some of the issues that what the Islamic political parties have in common. They have different interpretations of Sharia or Islamic law, but all of them, to make a sort of broad generalization, would like to bring back Islamic law and make it the law of the land, the law of the state. And those were the people that we were interested in. So not Islam as a personal choice, as it is for many people in the United States, but as this law, state law. And the way Sharia is interpreted by these groups raises a couple of questions. Okay, the first one is the fornication laws. Called Zina laws in Pakistan. The fact that fornication becomes a crime against the state, first of all, you can get into a lot of issues about exactly how that law is interpreted, but the first thing that happens, has happened in Iran, has happened in Afghanistan, has happened in Sudan, Saudi Arabia, other countries, is the separation of men and women, which, to Western view at least, seems to raise a lot of inequalities between education, civil rights, women's and men's ability to associate freely with each other. Then more specifically, the question of women being able to testify in fornication laws or suits In Pakistan, the rape laws and the fornication laws have been fused so that if a woman is raped and she doesn't have four male witnesses to attest to the act, then if she goes to the authorities and reports it, she can be accused of fornication and thrown in jail herself. And both men and women, if they have four male witnesses, can be, they theoretically can be stoned to death, although the sentences haven't been carried out there. And on a lesser evidence, they can get up to 10 years in prison. Second legal provision that raises questions is the question of obedience. Now, there's some debate over exactly what the Quran says about whether women or whether men have a responsibility for women, or they're superior. How exactly does one interpret those verses? But the way it has been interpreted in practical laws throughout the Middle East is to make women have a legal right, I mean a legal responsibility to be obedient to their husbands. And so that translates into, for example, laws in Sudan and Saudi Arabia that women in Iran, that women can't travel without permission from their husbands or their fathers or whoever their legal guardians, that their legal guardians have can decide whether they're allowed to work, whether they're allowed to be educated abroad. Okay. Another question, which Amina was going to talk about, but is polygamy. The fact that in since this Islamic movement has begun, there had been some move to make polygamy more conditional in Pakistan and Iran and Sudan and Egypt. Since this has started, men's right to unilateral right to marry as up to four wives has been restored, while women don't have the same right. Same goes for divorce laws. Danina says that there should be a period of waiting between between the number of times the times that a man renounces his wife. That's not always the way it's been interpreted. For example, in Pakistan, a man can say it, you know, in one, say it at once, and a woman would be divorced, whereas a woman has to go to court or to an arbitration to be divorced, so that seems unfair. Then the question of inheritance. It's true that in the Islamic system, a man would have a legal responsibility to support the women in his family. But on the other hand, a lot of people here would argue that a more fair system, that a lot of women would prefer to have the independence of inheriting their own money rather than to be dependent on a brother or husband or father. And then the fifth question, the question of hijab or veiling, something that's very controversial in the Middle East, and I have to agree completely with Amina that women should have the right to dress in whatever way they please. And for example, in Turkey, one of the big debates is that women are not allowed to wear hijab in government institutions, and many people consider that a violation of their human rights, just as they consider it a violation of women's human rights in Iran, in Sudan, in Saudi Arabia, in other places where they are legally required to wear a veil, or in Afghanistan. So, those are some of the main issues that were raised in the articles, and those are some of the things that these political movements have focused on as far as women are concerned. And that's it.
All right, we've finished with the first part of tonight's format. Before we start the second part, I noticed there are people standing at the back of the room. Again, if you came late, I would like to inform you that there is a hall immediately to my left with a projection screen, and you may go in there and sit down and you won't miss a thing, okay? I would also like to remind you that there will be a question and answer session coming up, and if you would like to submit a written question, please write it down and pass it to the person on the aisle, and someone from the MSA will be collecting those questions before that part of the debate starts. The second part of the debate consists of a discussion between the two speakers regarding certain issues which were discussed in the statements and were addressed in the Women of the Veil articles. I guess the logical place to start is with some of the five areas indicated in Ms. Scroggins' opening statements dealing with Sharia, Islamic law, and women. Specifically, I guess I would like to invite both speakers, and maybe I will ask Amina Assoumi to go first, regarding what the Islamic viewpoint is on women's testimony, men's testimony, and the fornication law situation in Pakistan.
It's true that the Zina law of Pakistan is as she described it. It's also true that it's not Islamic. Okay, in the Quran, it gives very clear guidance. And just a second. I'm going to get my glasses so I can read. To the reporter earlier, now I can't find it right like this. Okay, basically it states that in the Quran that if there are not four witnesses, the man can testify for him on the first time that he can ask the mouth of God. Okay? But now that woman is the same opportunity, and if she bears witness four times and on the wrath of God, that she's declared innocent. But it says in the Quran it's, and so that's what has to abide. Women's testimony is stronger than what husband's testimony is. But there are all of these women in the prisons in Pakistan cannot be denied. And the International Union of Muslim Women worked on this, but they very people have to educate now a little bit about Islam. And we can't just change the law. We're also going to have to make provisions for the women that are in the prisons, because we can't send them back to their families, because their families have not been educated and do not have the knowledge and the understanding, and they would do injury to them, and we know this. So while I'm standing here and telling you about Islam, it's Islam the ideal. It's not what's being practiced in Pakistan or any other place. These are cultural horrors, if you will, and the situation for the women when it comes to this is definitely a horror.
Would you like to make any comments?
Well, maybe I could ask a question.
Okay.
It's true that Pakistan does have a peculiar, specific set of laws, but on the larger issue of the fornication laws as they should be, and the question of segregation of men and women, which do you support? Do you think that that should be a legal obligation of the state?
Okay. Fornication and adultery are not personal, all right? They are crimes against society because they affect the entire family and the entire community. Adultery can be the cause of divorce. Fornication can be the cause of children who have no legal rights, who have no parents. These are crimes against society. These are not. The way they're accepted here, it's like, yo, it's nothing, okay, you go to bed, whatever, okay. It's just not, this isn't reality. Bad things come out of fornication, bad things come out of adultery, and they affect other people, not just the one person. So you have to be held accountable. You don't sacrifice all of society's rights for individual rights. There has to be a balance between individual and society. If you gotta have sex, you gotta get married. As simple as that.
Well, what would you think about...
Wait a minute. In Islam, all praise is for Allah. And I really ask you not to applaud anything that I say. If there's anything, please, you know, the praise is for Allah.
Well, what sort of measures, what do you think about some of the measures that have been taken in certain Islamic countries to keep men and women separate to prevent any sort of fornication or adultery from happening. You know, we can go through examples if you'd like.
Well, I don't think that absolute separation has any necessary place, because the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam, he ate with women that he wasn't married to. He ate from the same pot with them. He met and talked with them. He taught them. The total segregation actually comes from cultures outside of Islam, and it isn't necessary. Okay, that carries it too far. I agree to that. But the absolute total free mixing, this also is not necessary. If we're dealing with men on a level of business, on a level of education, on a level of profession, as a doctor or as a nurse or as a teacher or as a lawyer or whatever, that's one thing. But in the social mixing, with things like dancing and with a lot of other things that go on with social mixing, now again you're running into areas that can definitely cause problems. Very few women, if they were really being truthful, could say that if they saw their husband across a crowded room in a deep conversation with a voluptuous, beautiful woman in a skimpy gown, that she wouldn't have pangs of jealousy and suspicion. Very few really truthful men could say that if they saw their wives across a crowded room talking with a hunk that could compete with Adonis, that they wouldn't have some serious pangs of jealousy that could lead to suspicion. Jealousy is like a disease, and it grows, and it leads to serious problems in serious relationships. So absolute free mingling, there's not any need for it.
So you would support, you think that it is the role of the state to step in and prevent those sort of encounters?
Yes, I do.
Let me ask a follow-up question. One of the things, Sister, that you discussed in your opening statement was that men and women are different, but this does not affect their equality. To a Westerner, if he hears that, he thinks, well, if they're saying that they're different, then they have to, by definition, be not the same and are therefore in some manner unequal. How do you respond to the line of questioning that unless you treat them the same, they are in fact not equal?
Well, same and equal aren't the same. Even if you read in Webster, the definition in Webster for same and equal would not be the same. Same means without difference, and vive la différence. Men and women are different. Apples and oranges are different. Cats and dogs are different. It doesn't mean that one is less important than the other, that one has less value than the other. It just means that they're different. And the Quran states that we still have the same obligations. We have the same punishment for a crime. We have the same chance of getting into heaven. We have the same reward for the same deed done. There's no difference in the eyes of Allah. But to eat an orange, you peel it. To eat an apple, you don't.
Do you have any thoughts?
Well, I think that there's, you know, as we've gone over, I mean, there's certain areas of the law where women clearly are treated differently, and I would argue that, I mean, we had a debate in this country over separate but equal. Is that possible? And, you know, obviously I would side on the air to the side that they're treated differently under the law, and therefore it's not the same, and it's not equal. Men have certain rights that women get.
Okay. My next question, the next area that I'd like to address is in your article, by the way, most of you may not know that the article Women of the Veil, which appeared in the Milwaukee Journal, is actually a condensation of approximately 12 pages of newspaper articles down to 2 pages in the Milwaukee Journal. I would like to ask what kind of research and what kind of persons you talk to gain the understanding of Islam and Islamic law, which are contained in your article.
Well, as I said,
I've been covering the Middle East and writing about it for some time, but on this particular trip, we specifically tried to talk to political leaders, ordinary people who were affected by the laws, women who were active on both sides of the issues, lawyers. And why did we do that rather than, say, talking to Islamic scholars is a question that I've been asked a lot. And although we did, I did try to read that and talk to some of them, but the reason was because we were not interested in trying to establish, you know, the question that people have asked for 1400 years, you know, what is Islam, how should it be? That wasn't our question at all. It was, how is it being interpreted in certain countries right now, today? You know, how about this political movement that is actually in the Middle East today? What are they trying to do, and why are they trying to do it, and how are people responding to it? So that, for example, there's a lot of things in that I talk about in the articles, like, for example, different types of veiling, where, you know, people from another country will argue that Afghanistan is far too strict, it's not required by Islam, it's, you know, and their kind of total strict separation of the sexes is going too far, but too many Afghans, that is Islam, that's how they interpret it. So that's what we were interested in looking at, you know, how were people on the spot interpreting these laws.
Okay, would you recognize that there is a distinction to be made between Islam as it is contained in the Quran and the tradition of the Prophet and how different cultures may be interpreting it today?
Well, sure. I mean, absolutely. I mean, there's, you know, a billion Muslims in the world. Everyone is going to have a different interpretation of it, of Islam and what it is and what the Quran actually says. But there are some common areas, and like I said, well, I was not looking at the Quran and, you know, are these people interpreting it right or wrong, but instead just saying, here's how they are interpreting it now, and here's where they derive it from, where they get their legitimacy from in the Quran. Whether they've done that correctly or not is a different matter.
Could I ask Sister Sumi to comment on how different cultures have interacted with Islam?
Well, I'll be one of the first to admit that I see a lot of cultural pollution in Islam. And it's very distressing, not only to me, but to everyone else, because the cultural pollution is one of the things that keeps the Muslims from coming together. The thing about it is that in spite of the cultural pollution, no matter where someone is from, I can take this book and I can sit them down and I can say, okay, you do that in your country, but explain to me, why does it say this here? And 9 times out of 10, they come back and they will change what they were saying, because here we have the word of God, the word of Allah. And all of the Muslims, no matter where they're from, are willing to accept this. And this was what we took before the parliament 1.5 years ago in Pakistan and presented these ayahs regarding zina that they had to accept, they couldn't argue with. And it's these ayahs, this book, that will get those laws changed. Whether or not cultures are practicing things wrong or not is, to me in this case, almost irrelevant. If we were writing about the cultural practices of Catholics in Central America, or in Peru, or in Africa, or in Italy, or wherever, it would be listed as the practices of a particular country, and being Catholic would never come into it in spite of what they do being done by their interpretation of Catholicism. But whatever any Muslim does is, by our media, laid on all of us. And that's my objection. And if someone's going to write about Islam, you can look and talk to whoever you want to, and you can find somebody to say anything. We did an experiment in one community where we invited 13 different scholars into our community, and each time we had someone meet with them and lead them towards feeling that the community was a certain way, and we got all kinds of different verdicts on the issue that we put forward to them. You can find people to give whatever answer. But this is something different. And So like the issue of whether a woman could testify or not in Pakistan should have been said that, but then just reading these two verses of the Quran would have made it very clear that it's not Islamic to do that. And it distresses me that people of other religions in other countries, it's never put on their religion. It's not blamed on their religion. But with us, everything is blamed on our religion. And that people want to look at us through their eyes, they don't want to look at us through our eyes and see how we see ourselves and see what we are feeling and what we are thinking. I am American. I am a Muslim. And I want people to know what Islam is. And I want people to accept me as a human being, as a Muslim, in my hijab. But if journalists continue writing things that make people think that Muslims are ignorant fools for being Muslim, then I can't blame you guys for looking at me and giggling and snickering as I'm walking down the hallway in my abaya. I can't blame you. If I weren't a Muslim, if I didn't understand the way I look, then I might laugh at myself too. We're walking in here. When I first walked in, I walked past a group of students, and one of them almost fell on the floor laughing. He'd probably never seen anyone dressed like me. But that hurts. That's offensive. It doesn't make me insecure, but it's offensive and it hurts because my rights are being impended on. And one of the things that helps this is the way people present Islam all the time.
I will just raise one more issue before proceeding to the question and answer period with the audience. That issue has to do with the quotes from the Quran which are contained in the Women of the Veil series. My question to Deborah Scroggins is for the quotations from the Quran which were contained in the series. What translation did you choose and why did you choose it?
It's the Dawood, it's the Penguin translation, perfectly, simply, it's paperback. It was for sale in Pakistan, I bought it, you know. I had a smaller book called The Social Laws of the Quran, and then I found out that I really wasn't going to be able to get by with that. I needed to read the entire Quran, so that was the one that I bought. It just happened to be no particular reason.
Okay.
It just happened to be the one.
Sister, you read some of these passages quoting or translating the Quran contained in the Women of the Veil articles. Do you believe that those quotations contained in those articles are accurate?
They're probably accurate according to him. It's kind of beneficial if you know, when you're looking at a book on a particular subject, that you find someone who is knowledgeable of the particular subject, preferably when it comes to religion that they're practicing. I know that all over the world, and I chose to bring this one, I have 17 different translations, but this is the Yusuf Ali, and I know that this is the one that is read a great deal in Pakistan, but not as much as the Maududi, which I also have. And those would have been much better, and I think if she had read one of those instead of the one by this guy who's an Arab, but he's not a Muslim. It states so in the book, at the beginning of the book, it states that he is an Arab, but not a Muslim. And he does have, when I first reviewed the book, I advised against it because of the fact that he has ayats mixed up and he has things that are just way off the wall. Because I can take any of my 17 translations and read the same ayahs and come back with pretty close to the same thing, just a change in a word here or there, except for when you get into like this. So I don't blame Deborah for that one, except that I wish she had read instead of the book that he was, who he was, and then she might not have chosen that one.
Okay, that concludes tonight's program.
So I said, okay, I am open-minded now. I don't think